introduce this for the record. This is Dixie Noonan with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I am here with Greg Feldberg and Ryan Bubb, also of the commission. We are here with Pat Parkinson of the Federal Reserve and Dave Caperton. We are at the K Street offices of the Federal Reserve. Mr. Parkinson, if you would please, I understand that you are the director of the Division of Banking Supervision and Regulation. Is that correct?
Yes.
Dixie, can I just interrupt that this is confidential information subject to our confidentiality agreement?
Sure.
Thanks.
Thank you for that. And you took that role in October of 2009, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And then before that, what did you do at the Fed?
I've been at the Fed since 1980. I started out in the international division. To begin weaving in my derivatives history, one of the very first things I did was to evaluate proposals to trade on futures exchanges, Eurodollar futures contracts. So that was probably my first involvement with derivatives. I was in the international division for 3 or 4 years, then for a few years worked on monetary policy, then went to the Banking Supervision and Regulation Division from about 1985 to 1987, where, again, sort of drawing on my background with derivatives, I worked on developing the first capital requirements for counterparty exposures on derivatives as part of the U.S.-UK Capital Accord, which was a precursor to the Basel Capital Accord, which everybody knows about. Then I went back to research statistics right around the time of the 1987 stock market crash. Again, I had a lot of experience working with derivatives because at that time, at least some people, primarily people who worked for or derive their livings from the New York Stock Exchange, were convinced that it was trading of derivatives in Chicago that were responsible for all these terrible events. So that's his backdrop to now in the early 1990s, as derivatives trading is growing very rapidly, OTC derivatives trading. And the PWG, which was sort of revitalized in particular.
The PWG is the President's
Working Group. President's Working Group on Financial Markets was created by executive order by President Reagan in January, I do believe, maybe a little later, early 1988. PWG continues to operate under executive order. The members all along have been the Secretary of the Treasury as the chairman of the PWG, the chairman of the Fed, chairman of the CFTC, chairman of the SEC. That peculiar composition reflects its origins in the stock market crash, where those were the agencies that were primarily involved. Over time, especially under the Clinton administration, routinely the control of the currency, the chairman of the FDIC, the chairman of the OTS, and the chairman of the CEA, and then the NEC director would participate in those meetings, and it became a broader sort of financial coordination
committee. Was that by executive order that the group was expanded, or was that?
That was by the whims of then secretaries of the Treasury and the acquiescence of the other members.
So the Secretary of the Treasury really chairs the group?
Yes. In fact, at time to time, especially in the Bush administration, where the White House was very strong and the Treasury was relatively weak, they occasionally would point out that it is called the President's Working Group, and maybe the Secretary of the Treasury should pay at least some nominal attention to that. So, in any event, in the early 90s, I think even before the Clinton administration, there was some discussion as the CFTC occasionally would decide that perhaps OTC derivatives were futures contracts and therefore subject to their regulatory authority, and that created sparks with other agencies, SEC, Fed, etc. So there were some discussions, but I think it really came on strong when the Clinton administration came in. In early 1994, Secretary Benson, and at that time Rubin was the chairman of the NEC, clearly were concerned about the growth of derivatives and the implications it had for risk to the banking system, for systemic risk generally, and they decided to begin focusing attention on it. At some point...
I'm sorry, you said that they decided to focus attention on it because they believed it might pose a systemic risk?
Among other things. It was growing very rapidly. So they were reading in the papers. You had a famous speech by Jerry Corrigan of the New York Fed and now of Goldman Sachs, really raising, I forget how he put it, a speech to the New York State Bankers Association. It was either 1989 or 1990. And I remember one of his lines was, and if you know Jerry, it was... if this sounds like a warning, it's because it is. Any event, there were these concerns, and they were getting questions from Congress, and that became one of the principal focuses of the discussion of the PWG. It took a number of years to sort of finally crystallize into a PWG position on these matters, which was expressed in a November 1999 report that essentially set out what remains to this day the policy, although at this point everyone agrees, I think, that greater regulation is necessary, and there we can go into later the efforts on the Hill to address that.
When did you become involved in the PWG?
I would say I was involved all along because...
Starting in 1988.
Yes, but focused at that point on margin requirements, on issues around clearing and settlement, among the issues that came out of the stock market crash and the particular systemic threats that that crash posed. And at that point, it had nothing to do with OTC derivatives because, for all intents and purposes, there were no equity-based OTC derivatives in 1987. Mm-hmm. There were interest rate derivatives in their infancy, but no equity-based derivatives.
Would you mind describing what you mean by equity OTC derivative?
Well, in recent years, I'll never get dates exactly right. You can write derivatives, you know, derivatives that are traded, and we'll have to get later, I want to be clear about what a derivative is and the definition, because a lot of things get jumbled together and in an unhelpful way in regulatory discussions. But, you know, we start, in terms of over-the-counter derivatives, which are sort of privately negotiated bilateral contracts to transfer risk, they were first developed for interest rate risk, and in particular, interest rate swaps took off in the early 1980s. You always had markets for spot and forward foreign exchange. Early on, foreign exchange options markets grew, cross-currency swap markets grew, foreign exchange or currency swap markets grew. So, and those remain to this day the biggest underlying asset classes, interest rates and FX. But over time, derivatives developed on all kinds of other things. I would say the principal other categories are equities, credit, the now infamous credit default swaps, and commodities. There are derivatives on oil, on natural gas, on various kinds of metals and such that are traded in the over-the-counter markets, and probably all kinds of things that even I don't know about, because you can write a derivative contract on literally anything. They write it on the weather now, you know, all sorts of things. But, again, back in 1987, nothing really but interest rates wasn't the issue. You get into the early 90s, people start asking questions. Corrigan gives his famous warning. Others are given warnings. Rubin's interested. Benson's interested. Everybody's interested in what policy should be.
Did you talk to Corrigan about his concerns?
I think at that point, I didn't talk to Jerry Corrigan. I was the chief of the capital markets section in R&S. Others talked to Jerry Corrigan. I may have talked to him once or twice, but... He had a variety of concerns, but I think most of them ended up focusing on, and this is an important thing to recognize, on risk to the banks that he supervised and we supervised by virtue of the central role that they play in the over-the-counter derivatives market as dealers in those products. But let's get to the heart of things. And I won't get the dates right, sometime in the mid to late 1990s, Brooksley Bourne becomes CFTC chairman, and she succeeded, Wendy Graham, and I don't know whether she was, I don't remember whether she was the first, I think we probably had, Sheila Bair is acting chairman of the CFTC early in the Clinton administration, before the Clinton administration could put their own person in there. And they put in Brooksley Bourne, and Brooksley Bourne, did have a view that derivatives, well, she was very careful. She said she wanted to enter, she ultimately issued a concept release, which suggested that OTC derivatives, particularly interest rate derivatives, because that was the focus of interest and concern at the time, ought to be regulated as futures contracts by the CFTC. And she did that after a year or so of debate within the PWG about what the policy should be. And that, by that time, Rubin is Treasury Secretary. And it's Arthur Levitt, and it's Greenspan, and it's Bourne. And, you know, frankly, there was a diversity of views on it. Indeed, Rubin, I think, was not certainly dead set against derivatives being regulated by the CFTC or anybody else.
May I just stop you there, Rose?
Yeah.
Were you personally at these meetings?
Yes.
Okay, so you're speaking from your personal recollection. Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
May not be crystal clear, but
of course, but I wanted to clarify that.
Yes, I think I attended. I can't say I attended every last one. I was invited to attend every last one, and I think I was there at some of the ones that you hear about on Frontline and whatnot. In fact, I think somebody told me I'm in the background, the pictures on Frontline. Well, I've never watched the famous Brooks Lee-Bourne canonization program. In any event, there were real concerns, complicated issues and concerns about whether derivatives really were for its futures, whether they really had the legal authority. And in particular, when it came to FX derivatives, there is something called the Treasury Amendment to the Commodity Exchange Act that carved out from CFTC FX and Treasury instruments and gave that authority to the Treasury Department. So they were kind of, especially the legal departments of the two places, had a little bit of this going on. In any event, when she, despite Rubin's pleas that she not go out on her own and that she wait and they go out jointly as a PWG request for information, that led to this famous confrontation. In any event, she then leaves the CFTC, Bill Rayner, which replaces
when
her.
When you say this famous confrontation, you're referring to?
Well, the meeting where Rubin and Larry Summers and others tried to dissuade her from going out on her own. But you can watch the Frontline video. I'm told it's very, very good, very dramatic.
I just want to make sure we both understand the same thing.
Yeah. Nonetheless, the PWG, working together, continued to analyze these issues and debate them. And with Brooksley then gone, they were able to reach consensus. And in November 1999, produced this report on over-the-counter derivatives of the Commodity Exchange Act.
So Brooks Lee-Bourne would have been an impediment to reaching that consensus.
Yeah, I think she is a person who has the courage of her convictions, and she didn't agree with it, and was not a person is not a compromising personality by her nature, which could be a good thing or a bad thing depending on what you're trying to get done. And in any event, after she left, there was agreement that OTC derivatives should not be regulated under the Commodity Exchange Act. However, it really was an analysis of what are the purposes of the Commodity Exchange Act. In fact, that's a general statement, which I'll give caveats in a moment. They said the purpose of derivatives, or the purpose of regulation of the Commodity Exchange Act is primarily, in fact, its history is to prevent market manipulation. And then as an investor protection aspect. So the PWG actually concluded that financial derivatives should not be subject to regulation of the Commodity Exchange Act because they were not susceptible to manipulation, but did not recommend excluding derivatives on non-financial things from the Commodity Exchange Act. And they said that these exclusions should only apply to transactions between sophisticated market participants, so the retail people. The argument was that those kind of people could protect themselves. It was acknowledged that there were classes of people, retail individuals, who could not protect themselves, who needed the protection of government, and therefore should be allowed to enter into these transactions only if they were transacted on an exchange subject to the regulatory protections that apply on exchange.
So was that idea codified in law or regulation? That you had to be a sort of sophisticated investor?
It was codified in the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000.
Thank you.
So you'll note there was a year that elapsed between the PWG's report and the one respect in which the Congress deviated from two respects. One definitely was with respect to non-financial commodities, where they expanded it to where the trading of non-financial derivatives between sophisticated counterparties was also excluded from the Commodity Exchange Act, coverage of the Commodity Exchange Act. Now, there was always the argument that whether swaps were futures in the first place or whether they ever had any authority in the first place, but it clarified that they did not. And there's a very complicated, more than this being the United States, greater than 1,000-word-long definition of something called eligible swap participant, which is the people that can engage in OTC derivatives transactions free from the constraints of the Commodity Exchange Act. So that culminated in 1999 with that. The law passed in 2000. And I would say There was little further agitation of the OTC derivatives issue until things started falling apart in recent years. And even, in fact, I think if you went back and read the PWG's account of the causes and his sort of the transmission of the crisis that dates to early 2008, there's hardly any mention of OTC derivatives to that point. But as we'll discuss later, I assume, it has since become evident that derivatives in various ways did amplify the financial crisis, to get to one of your key questions. Then to continue on with my history, the thing that in the intervening years, the main thing I was involved in with respect to derivatives, because again, it was not a big issue within the PWG, at least in my recollection, in terms of whether they should be regulated under the Commodity Exchange Act. There was a continuing intense interest with a couple of matters. One, and it waxed and it waned, but it was particularly strong from, say, 2004. President Geithner at the New York Fed was very worried about the infrastructure of the OTC derivatives markets, and especially when he got to Treasury, Paulson was very worried about counterparty credit exposures between banks and other participants in the OTC derivatives. So we actually did a whole lot of work on understanding those things.
What was the time frame on this?
It was after what Paulson came in 2006, I do believe. So it would have been beginning shortly after that. The work on the infrastructure goes all the way back. This is both sort of to our credit and to our embarrassment. I mean, I was the chair of a BIS group that published this report in 1998.
A report entitled OTC Derivatives, Settlement Procedures, and Counterparty Risk Management.
Yes. And it made various recommendations that nothing much ever happened with about strengthening the infrastructure. And then again in 1997, I'll get my dates wrong, but something like 2003, 2004, Geithner becomes president of the New York Fed, and he was very interested in these issues. And we launched, under his chairmanship of this international committee, another study, which I again chaired. And he really pushed his people on evaluating and examining and studying. You can read the title. It's another one.
So this is also a Bank for International Settlements March 2007 report, New Developments in Clearing and Settlement Arrangements for OTC Derivatives.
Right. So 1999, PWG says these things don't need to be regulated under the Commodity Exchange Act. 2000, Congress takes that even further in the Commodity Futures Modernization Act and really creates even broader exemption from regulation under the commodity laws. I guess the point I would make is that that did not mean that derivatives were unregulated. The sense in which they were regulated was that derivatives markets, by their nature, almost all transactions involve a dealer on one side or the other of the transaction. They're intermediated by dealers, by big financial firms, by and large. And almost always, unfortunately not always, but almost always, those dealers are regulated financial institutions. Internationally, outside the United States, they're just almost always banks. Within the United States, the principal exceptions always have been, number one, first and foremost, legal entities which are part of the big five securities firms. So, you know, the ones we all know by now.
And you're talking about the broker-dealers.
Yeah, yeah, it's Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns, and Lehman Brothers were the big five that were not organized as bank holding companies or regulated as banks.
Who would their regulator have been?
Well, back in 99, it would have been nobody. But I think, Greg, I was just reading your report on Fed supervision. I read the other day. It was a good trip down memory lane to try to get dates right. I think it was in 2004 that the European Commission decided that those firms who actually, while they don't own banks in the United States, things that are considered banks for purposes of the Bank Holding Company Act, they do own banks in Europe. Mm-hmm. And they decided that if somebody owned a bank in Europe, they had to be subject to consolidated supervision. Mm-hmm. And they said, United States, either you provide the consolidated supervision or we in Europe will be happy to do so for your firms. And nobody thought that was a good idea. So what happened? Did not a single one of them, as Greg report points out, chose to be regulated by the Federal Reserve as bank holding companies. Instead, all the securities firms went for the voluntary, you know, supervisory regime that the SEC created to allow them to comply with these EU requirements.
So let's go back to your statement that there was supervision and regulation of this market, and these were the broker-dealers that were involved in this market. So from 1999 to 2004, who would have been?
Well, I think even back then, going back all the way to, and we're going to come back to another famous incident, LTCM, it was in 98. Mm-hmm. And coming out of that, even though I think technically the SEC's authority was limited to broker-dealers and they had very limited authority beyond that to collect information from affiliates of broker-dealers, they nonetheless undertook to apply a sort of supervision to those securities firms. And indeed, the standards post-LTCM with respect to counterparty risk management that were promulgated by the Basel Committee were jointly promulgated with IOSCO.
And what is IOSCO?
The International Organization of Securities Commissions. And the main reason for expanding that to IOSCO was because of the U.S. securities firms regulated by the SEC who were not subject to the Basel framework. So there was a sort of regulation going on back then. It wasn't the way we regulate banks. And then I think it became a little more intense once they formally instituted the CSE regime, but it was never quite the same as the way we regulated bank holding companies. But nonetheless, SEC was aware of the issues, asked questions, examined, et cetera, et cetera, examined after a fashion, et cetera, et cetera. And then when Paulson came in, we spent a lot of time worrying about potential failures of counterparty risk management in the derivatives markets. I think, and when I get to sort of what went wrong, I think a couple of things went wrong, but one of the things...
So what was the date, for time period around which that came into being, you said, when you started worrying about... So this was still...
We were worried all the way from, you know, post-LTCM in 1998 to the present. There was a lot of work on in terms of bank supervisors and working with the SEC to cover the securities firms.
At some point, did that concern increase?
I think that Paulson came to office. I think Tim was concerned about it, in part because he heard expressions of concern from the street. Corrigan. There was also, this is coming back to me, a bunch of reports by the Counterparty Risk Management Policy Group, which is a private sector group that Jerry Corrigan put together on several occasions. And they expressed concern, and I think they and other Wall Street CEOs, when Tim came in, when he would ask them, what are you worried about, was one of the things they were worried about. So he made it an emphasis of New York Fed supervision to carefully study the counterparty exposures. And then when Hank came in, he was very concerned about it, too. And to that point, You could be skeptical. You could say, well, this has been going on for 20 years and nothing bad has happened. But he was concerned. We carefully studied it. I think we were misled. It's not as if we were sanguine, but the numbers, as far as they went, were encouraging or reassuring. And I think
numbers for what?
Well, we'd go and ask the banks, you know, who are your biggest counterparties? What are the size of your exposures? We look at that relative to their capital, and it didn't look so bad. And where did we go wrong? I think two things. One, we were really fixated from back in 1998, post-LTCM, we used to talk about managing derivatives exposures to highly leveraged institutions. But I think over time, we increasingly construed highly leveraged institutions to mean hedge funds. So there was a lot of focus, essentially fighting the last war, about worrying about exposures to hedge funds and not so much about exposures to other entities who might be large and highly leveraged, like AIG or like the monoline insurance companies. The other thing is, even if we had focused on those, just to be clear, the way you measure exposures on derivatives, there's something called the current exposure. In other words, you mark the contracts to market at current market prices. And if they owe you money, if the contract is valuable to you, so that their defaulting might cost you money, that creates what we call current exposure. But then we understand you know, for example, an interest rate swap, at the time you enter into the contract, it's entered into at market, so initially there's no exposure. That can't be the right answer. Clearly there's a chance it's going to go into the money and you'll be exposed. So we have a concept of potential future exposure or expected future positive exposure. There are a bunch of concepts, all of which try to gauge the risk that even though there's no exposure today, there could be exposure in the future. And where have just the huge, humongous, god-awful losses been on derivatives? It's been on the structured credit products where they wrote protection on AAA-rated tranches of securitizations. And I'm pretty sure when they measured their potential exposure on that, they said, well, historically, these AAA tranches have never deviated from par. So the potential future exposure on these things is negligible. And
when you say they, you mean the counterparties to these
banks. The banks who were the counterparties to AIG or to the monoline insurers. And, you know, we looked, I don't know how in-depth we looked at their measurement of, in general, we worried about their measurement of potential future exposure and its limitations, but did we fully appreciate just how many how much exposure they had to AIG and the monolines on those kinds of products? And even if we did we question the assumption that just because they had already but always been at par, would they always be at par? I don't know how in depth or a good question for those on the supervisory that worked in supervision when this was going on. But that was, and clearly, when you ask how did derivatives contribute to the financial crisis, I mean, clearly the losses on the derivatives dragged down AIG, and AIG, if we hadn't intervened, would have posed significant threat to the banks. Monolines, they lost huge amounts of money under dealings with monolines where nobody bailed them out. Eventually, they I think, agreed to tear up a lot of those contracts, but not at market prices, at prices that caused them to incur billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars of losses. The second thing was...
So let me ask, just interject briefly. I think you said that you looked at banks and what their counterparty mm-hmm. exposures were and what those concentrations mm-hmm. were. Would that have picked up AIG as one of their counterparty exposures?
In principle, but I don't think in practice.
And why do you think that got missed?
Because there was no current exposure, and as measured, there was no potential future exposure.
Okay. Would you mind, I don't know if this is related or not, but one of the questions I have in looking at this issue is the difference between the notional amount mm-hmm. of derivatives versus mm-hmm. the amount that's actually at risk in a
right.
derivatives contract. Would you explain what your view is on the difference between those two concepts?
Well,
if any?
There's a big difference.
And does that relate to this idea of current exposure or expected future exposure?
Well, I'll try to walk you through an example.
Okay.
We'll keep it simple. It's an interest rate swap. And it's for a notional amount of, I don't know, whatever you'd like, $1 billion. The way an exposure, when you enter into it, let's suppose you're receiving fixed, and the interest rate at the time, market interest rate for receiving fixed, is 7%, and there's no exposure. Exposure is going to rise if you're receiving fixed if rates decline, because then if he defaults and I go out and I try to replace that contract, I won't get 7 anymore. I'll get 5 or 6 or 4 or whatever. And then the question is, what would be the amount you could lose in that? What would be the amount of loss? What would be the replacement cost of that contract, which is nowhere near, even with extreme movements in interest rates, it's nowhere near $1 billion or whatever my example is. It's a fraction of that. It's 3, 6, 10, 12% of $1 billion. So that begins to indicate why the notional amount may not be so helpful. Worse yet, suppose that I entered into two interest rate swaps. First, I entered into a swap where I received fixed at 7%, and now I turn around and enter another one where I pay fixed at 5%. Well, they can't both be in the money, right? So it means that they offset. So if you added up $1 billion and $1 billion, got $2 billion, and thought, well, that's first you had exposure of $1 billion, now you got your twice as risky because you entered into that second trade. No, you're clearly less risky than when you had only one transaction. So it's pretty clear that notional amounts, other than for scaring people, aren't of much use for measuring risk.
Is that true for credit derivatives as well?
It could be true for credit derivatives as well. I mean, it would be the same principle that again, your what is the replacement cost? Suppose that I purchase protection on a particular name, and now my counterparty defaults. When do I lose, and how much do I lose? Well, I lose only if the cost of protection has gone up since the time I first purchased it, because then it's going to cost me more to replace the defaulted contract.
That assumes that you can get protection from someone else.
Yeah.
At a higher cost.
Yeah. And to be sure, it would have been very costly for some of some of these structured credit products once the market lost confidence. For most things, and this is sort of where I think things are interesting, where people saw, they didn't see those transactions as being terribly risky, the transactions in highly rated structured credit products.
Why not?
Because they were strapped. They didn't, nobody thought, even the only scenario in which you're buying a AAA tranche of a mortgage-backed security is going to result in significant loss would be in the event of a major collapse in housing prices. And this is, again, where people, I think, and lots of people, simply said, we have not had a nationwide decline in housing prices since the 1930s, and we just don't see that as a significant risk. Even people, you know, yes, you can find somebody who said, I guess it's Mr. Paulson from the famous Paulson hedge fund, not Hank Paulson, the one that made all the money shorting the housing market. I guess he got it, that you could have a decline in nationwide housing rates. But even pessimists, circa 2004 or 2005, I think the sort of Fed view was, well, this can't continue. Housing price inflation is going to moderate and go back down to where, you know, maybe it'll continue to appreciate, but at very low rates. And then as things started to get bad, I remember because we were doing stress tests on the bank portfolio, we'd say, okay, we'll look at an extreme scenario where nationwide housing prices go down 10%. Now, mind you, this has never, ever happened in the history of the United States, but we're going to ask them, what would happen if it goes down 10%? Well, of course, it went down 30 or 40%. But I think people just, to use a term I've heard generalists use, part of this was a failure of imagination. Just things happened that people found unimaginable. And obviously, they were wrong. But there were lots of those people.
Are you familiar with some accounts of hedge funds engaging in trades to short sort of the subprime market?
Sure.
That base their analysis on the idea that housing prices didn't actually have to fall in order for some of these tranches to lose money. Instead, house prices just had to quit going up?
That I'm not familiar with, no. Might be right. I don't know enough about how some of the instruments might have been structured. But I think that, by and large, now they could be right, depending on how, the thought was, again, this is the thought process of things. Unless prices go down, if what the real risk is that people are going to default on their mortgages, people don't default on their mortgages when the price is going up. Why would you default on, if the price now is higher than the price when you bought it? It's true that I lose my job, I've always heard it's divorce and it's job loss. You know, you ask white people, other than in our recent experience, historically, why did people default on their mortgages? It was divorce, it was illness, it was idiosyncratic sort of things, and maybe it was unemployment, but we've been through cycles like in the early 80s, lots of unemployment, and people didn't default on their mortgages all that much. And why not, if there's any way you can cobble it? I mean, hell, you'd sell the thing. If it's in the money, if your house is worth more than the mortgage, sell the house, get your money out. You know, don't give it to the bank. So I think that was the reasoning. But, yeah, there were lots of them. And now you were bringing me to another point. Another way in which derivatives, I think, added fuel to the fire was the synthetic CDO, ABS CDO market, where but this sort of it illustrates a number of points. You had all these investors, and one group that's gotten off scot-free in this whole thing is the investors, and even worse yet, the advisors, the investment advisors to the institutional investors, who basically could not get enough of this highly rated structured credit stuff. So much so that they literally securitized every last nickel of subprime, at least of the riskier, the mezzanine tranches of the subprime securitizations. And still, there was demand for ABS CDOs grounded on subprime exposure. So what did they do? They created more of it synthetically. So in that sense, by accommodating the demands of investors and accommodating the desires of the short sellers to make money, it meant that there were more losses. You know, the losses were not confined to the direct effects. They multiplied the effects of the collapse in subprime.
So synthetic CDOs and structured credit products, instead of the original idea of derivatives, which I believe was to transfer risk, these actually added a net risk
to the
system.
Well, they transferred risk, but they transferred risk not to people that had an exposure they were trying to reduce, but allowing people to, on both sides, to ramp up their exposure.
So this sounds like there have been some lessons learned from the President's Working Group initial report in 1999 on OTC derivatives.
Right. Well, we can come to that. I mean, I also, having been part of the problem, I guess I was able to be part of at least what we think is the solution. I spent 6 months at the Treasury Department. Greg was there the latter part of that, I guess, but from January to July of last year. And the parts of the, I guess it's fair to say I wrote big chunks of this, but especially...
financial regulatory reform.
Yeah, especially... wrote would be too strong. I helped write big parts of this under the guidance of the Secretary of Treasury and the Chairman of the National Economic Council. Very close, painful guidance at time, I might add. The section on derivatives in particular was one I worked on with Gary Gensler, the new chairman of the CFTC, and Mary Shapiro. And it calls for comprehensive regulation of the derivatives markets. It calls for essentially having all dealers being regulated, regardless of whether they're banks or not. It also calls for other major participants in the market, other ones who are creating large exposures to other market participants, to be regulated. So that picks up on the AIG and monoline points. You know,
would that also pick up hedge funds?
In principle, I mean, that would be a good... That's the debate they're having on Capitol Hill. I mean, it's a question of... again, I'm not really close to what's going on the Hill. I think I tell people if giving me my current job was a secret plot to get me out of the derivatives debate, it worked. It's been completely effective. I don't have any time to follow this, much less to influence it. I think what they're fighting about is this so-called definition of major swap participant, which is fraught with implications under the general structure of the... So if you're a major swap participant and you're trading a standardized contract, it has to be clear. That would be thing one. If you're a major swap participant, you're going to be subject to prudential regulation. That's probably the first place to start. If you're a major swap participant, you have to be subject to prudential regulation by somebody. If you're a major swap participant and you're dealing in a standardized contract, it has to be cleared. I think those are the two. I'm trying to think. I'm fading, but I think there's a third implication, but it's very important.
What about exchanges?
I do believe that, let's see, how did they deal with exchanges? I think with respect to exchanges, it really depends on the product. And if the product, I may have this not exactly right, but the general notion is if a product could be safely cleared, it should be safely cleared. And if it's...
And who decides if it could be?
Well, this is into, I think they now have the CFTC or SEC or somebody deciding this question. But the whole, to get back to the main point, this major swap participant definition is critical, and that's one of the things they obviously can't reach agreement on. It's clear that it should include all the dealers. It's clear that it should include anybody as big as AIG. On the other hand, it's pretty clear that the senators, by and large, do not want it applying to the 3M Corporation or other corporate end users of derivatives because... essentially, I think the argument is if you're forced to trade, in particular with respect to the exchange trading requirements, if you're forced to trade on exchange, that's going to be a standardized contract. If it's a standardized contract and you're trying to use it for hedging, you probably cannot meet the requirements the accountants impose for it to be accounted for as a hedge. If you can't do that, you entered into a transaction that actually economically is intended as a hedge, but you're marking the derivative of the market, but not your cash position. Your earnings are made more volatile, not less, by your efforts to hedge. So I think there's a pretty strong case that, as a general matter, you don't want corporate users being subjected to the exchange trading requirement. So it's pretty clear, coming back to the major swap participant, that there's some group of corporate end users who will not be deemed major swap participants. And then there's this gray area in the middle, hedge funds. Well, clearly, if they engaged in AIG or LTCM-like scale of transactions, I think everybody would agree they're major swap participants. But whether there should be some broad exemption for whether hedge funds that are not transacting in large size should be subject to regulation is a different issue. And it's kind of related to another part of reg reform, which doesn't seem to be controversial, is that, as a general matter, hedge funds are not subject to prudential regulation. It's registration, it's information collection. So they could, unless they have such large positions in financial markets that become systemic, in which case they get swept into the systemic risk regime, they're not going to be subject to prudential regulation. But under some versions of the derivatives legislation, the first time they do a single derivatives trade, right? You know, one hedge fund is going to single derivatives trade. You have another hedge fund who's just gargantuan, but has managed to stay away from OTC. Maybe he's got enormous positions on exchange-traded derivatives, as LTCM did. He doesn't get regulated, but so you can begin to see that there are some complicated boundary drawing things here that somebody, not me, has to figure out.
Are you going to define derivative?
Well, I think the one thing was just in maybe the email I got that drives me crazy is that at least when one looks back on the PWG report and on the debate that we had, it was about these privately negotiated bilateral contracts that some thought were futures contracts. A CDO is a security. No one ever, the SEC would have gone crazy and did go crazy when occasionally the CFTC wanted to regulate things that were securities. They said, no. The claim that they're unregulated is just false. They're regulated by us. We have clear authority to regulate CDOs, securitizations. Oh, it's one can question whether they did a very good job of it, but it certainly wasn't that anyone lacked authority to regulate those things. They had all the authority they wanted. So, and then, in fact, there are references to repos. Again, a repo is not a derivative. Repo is a transaction for financing a securities position, et cetera, et cetera. But nonetheless, many people do think, the common journalist often thinks of a CDO as a derivative. And even it gets, of course, more complicated because a synthetic CDO, the security that issued is not a derivative, but the transaction that allowed the trust that issued the securities to take on the exposure was a derivative transaction. So in a synthetic CDO, you know, in a cash CDO, the CDO manager buys securities, right? Puts them into the trust, and now the trust issues securities to investors.
Well, now help me understand this, because my understanding of the makeup of a synthetic CDO is that it's made up of credit default swaps, or at least they were.
That's
some
correct.
Of them were.
Yeah.
And a credit default swap is a derivative. So if you package up a bunch of derivatives and then turn them into a security, I understand you to be saying that a synthetic CDO in that instance is a security, but what about the underlying assets of that?
Those are derivatives.
And would those be regulated, or because they...
Sure.
And how exactly would that work?
Well, how exactly would that work? Just the various provisions that we're talking about for OTC derivatives regulation, the CDO manager, in all likelihood, certainly today, it entered into those CDS transactions with derivatives dealers. Derivatives dealers regulated. It may well be, depending on where this comes out, that derivatives, well, no, that wouldn't be the case because the The CDO manager is selling protection. So it may well be that the derivatives dealer has to impose margin requirements on the transactions with the CDO manager. The transactions with the CDO manager would become transparent because they'd have to be reported to a trade repository under all the legislation that's being mm-hmm. talked about. If they were standardized contracts, they might well have to be traded on an exchange.
But presumably they're traded once to go into the CDO.
Yes.
And then from then on, the trading only occurs in the securities.
Right. Okay. Well, just as today, you know, if you're buying a security issued by, there are things called derivatives products company. There are these DPCs that exist to write protection on various corporate names. And how do they finance themselves? Through issuing equity and debt. So you buy those securities, you're not buying a derivative, you're buying an equity or you're buying a debt instrument, but if you're going to be analyzing what's the likelihood I'm going to get repaid on that debt instrument or the likelihood that I'm going to get a positive return on my equity investment, you have to analyze what the implications of that entity entering into derivatives transactions are for the quality of your debt. But
I just wonder, I hadn't actually thought about it in this way, so.
But those securities are regulated by the SEC. You know, there the main issues seem to be around transparency and around the rating agencies and the regulatory. So in some sense, the regulatory answer to worries about CDOs or even synthetic CDOs is to make sure that the securities that are issued by the CDO instruments themselves are appropriately transparent, that the rating agencies do a better job than they have been doing of rating them center. So it's dealt with in a different part of the reg reform package. And that's the other thing. All these, I think, it's what makes it so difficult as a presentational matter, for example. All these things are interrelated. And if you're expecting the proposals under derivatives to solve all the problems of financial crisis, no, that was never the intention. But if you think of a problem that hasn't been solved by what's being recommended, it's worth asking, well, do you agree that's a problem? If you do, well, which other chapter in here deals with that?
Right, but it sounds like even going forward under the proposed regulatory reforms on derivatives that a synthetic CDO would be subject to SEC supervision but would still not be regulated under the derivatives reforms.
The transaction between the CDO manager and whoever is the other counterparty to the CDS transaction that created the exposure to the CDO manager's exposure that he's now securitizing, that would be subject to regulation as a derivative. It's a credit default swap. And all credit default swaps are subject to the framework regardless of whether they're being used to create a synthetic CDO or they're being used to hedge an exposure to holding a corporate bond or they're being entered into by a hedge fund to bid on the demise of Morgan Stanley. They're all subject. That's the sense in which the derivatives regulation framework is comprehensive.
So you were talking about the role that derivatives played in the financial crisis, and you talked about AIG and the monolines. Are there other things that you think we should be looking at in terms of the role derivatives played in the financial crisis?
I think those are the principal things. I mean, you could say on the one hand, you had entities like AIG or the monolines that were unregulated but not effectively regulated and took on tremendous leverage through these transactions and whose failure was, or mere failure, was traumatic to the system. Then you can ask yourself, well, how did that happen? It's because the counterparties to those entities didn't effectively manage their counterparty exposures. Those counterparties, for the most part, were banks or other financial institutions, and obviously there were risk management failures at the banks, and corresponding to that, there were failures. We never like to use that word, but obviously the supervisors of those entities didn't. There were shortcomings. We like shortcomings. There were shortcomings in their supervision of those entities. failures by the private institutions, shortcomings by the government. Important distinction.
What could have given the regulators better tools to assess these risks?
Well, as I said earlier, some of this is failure of imagination. I don't know how you prevent a failure of imagination. I do think, and this you'll get a debate about this. The question is, did people know about the scale of AIG's activity or the scale of the monoline's activity? Did we know just exactly how rapidly the ABS CDO markets and the synthetic ABS CDO markets were growing? I would say I certainly didn't. I would say many and probably most regulators didn't. Other people in the market, a guy in here the other day was a hedge fund guy, smart guy with his ear to the ground, said he knew about AIG. He thought they were crazy. He wondered why anybody dealt with them. Why those sorts of questions weren't being raised by regulators, whether I think, again, answering for myself, I didn't know AIG was operating on that scale. Although, to be fair, again, if you go back, another couple of interesting reports I had not much to do with were, there were two reports, one report in particular in 2005 by the Joint Forum. The Joint Forum brings together the Basel Committee, IOSCO, and the International Association of Insurance Providers. And they issued a report on credit risk transfer. And I think if you read that report, they were well aware of the role that the monolines were playing. I don't think it mentioned AIG, but I've never gone back and looked. But they were certainly aware of the monolines. And they looked at that and they said, you know, there are large notional amounts of derivatives transactions involving the monolines. And at first blush, that looks pretty risky. But when we looked into it more deeply, we realized they were only writing protection on the most senior, most highly rated, super senior tranches. So maybe it's not so risky. So I think, nonetheless, it's hard to argue that more information wouldn't be better, particularly when I think once we've already made a lot of progress in terms of having a trade information warehouse for CDS, we need to build them for the other product segments. But once they exist, the sort of marginal cost of reporting those trades and maintaining the information and making aggregate information publicly available and micro information available to all the regulators is, I think, pretty small. It's a pretty small tax on the industry. Even in talking to industry people last couple of years, I would say, you know, for example, every time there's a rumor that there's manipulation, that the reason the CDS spread of XYZ has gone up, and you ask the CEO, he's going to say, well, it's obvious it's manipulation. There's nothing wrong with my firm. It's we're perfectly healthy. And, you know, the SEC, you know, papers the street with subpoenas. Well, that's just wasteful activity. I mean, if we had the warehouse, they could look in the warehouse and see, all right, who is? You know, there are a gazillion hedge funds. Which of them have been writing protection on net to that particular company? And then they could focus their inquiries and they could say, okay, we see hedge fund ABC, you have a big, you've purchased a lot of protection on Lehman Brothers. Why is that? And the answer might be because Lehman Brothers is my prime broker. I'm scared shitless. They're going to go down, and they're going to take half of my firm down with them. So I was smart, and I bought protection, and now I sleep better at night, in which case I think you could move on to the next hedge fund if they can prove that, in fact, that's the case. And then there'll be some that just were making a bet that Lehman was going to deteriorate. And then one could ask, were they doing anything? Was it part of some, say, complicated strategy where they wrote the protection to drive the CDS spread up and then they were shorting the stock in the sort of way that, you know, was a manipulative strategy? Like, all that's horribly hard to prove, but at least the SEC could focus its flashlight on the most promising parts or the most questionable parts of the activity rather than wasting a lot of time questioning people who didn't even have a position or had a perfectly reasonable explanation why they had that position.
So you said that you don't think that it's an unreasonable cost to put on the industry to have these disclosures and regulations?
I don't even think the industry's fighting that anymore.
And
for the warehouse, I don't hear anything about that.
So why do you think it is that you and others involved in the president's working group back in 1999 did think that was a problem? I'm trying to determine whether it was part of sort of the broader deregulatory mindset or whether it really was you looked at it and just didn't see, needed that sort of evidence to see what the problem might be.
Right. I think it's two things. One, there was a deregulatory mindset. There was a view that market discipline would police this stuff effectively. A view that gained strength as we went through years after years and cycles after cycle where that certainly appeared to be the case. I think in particular, if you look at Greenspan's statements, they became much... Greenspan sort of started out, in my view, he probably wouldn't agree with this entirely, but started out mainly as a skeptic of the effectiveness of government regulation. Not so much tremendously confident that market discipline was all-powerful, but skeptical of the effectiveness of regulation. You know, Greg and his colleagues in supervision, who got to know them, they were skeptical they were going to get anything done right. But over time, in particular, post-2001, when we went through a pretty sharp credit cycle with a big spike in corporate defaults, and the banking system was unscathed. I mean, there was no reduction in capital. The bigger firms maybe lost a quarter of earnings, but they marched on. And why was that? It was because in that instance, risk was dispersed, and there were no concentrations, and there was no fallout. But then I think the problem becomes, if one stepped back and thought about it, well, because these instruments can be used to disperse risk, and indeed because in 2001 they were used to disperse risk, logically that doesn't imply that going forward they always would be. And in fact, going forward, they weren't. They were used to concentrate risk in places like AIG and the model lines and other places that came to bite us in the hindquarters. You know, the other thing was the confidence, the realization that the major dealers were subject to regulation, and we thought we were doing a pretty good job. And in some respects, we did do a pretty good job. I mean, with all the market volatility and illiquidity, and all the losses and collapse of various hedge funds, that didn't affect the banking industry much at all, except when they bailed out their own hedge funds. But as long as they were dealing with somebody else's hedge fund, not much evidence that was a major source of losses. So had they applied the same rigorous, I mean, this is where I can argue this both ways. One simple point, which I think is going too far, had they applied the same rigorous counterparty discipline to AIG and the model lines that they did to the hedge funds, they would have been okay. And as I start to say that, I think, well, I'm still not sure whether it was that they didn't apply the same discipline or that when they looked at it in the context of AAA rated structured credit products, they just didn't see any risk, right? I mean, and AIG becomes sort of, or the monolines, it's like if you want to put somebody to sleep and get them, lull them into not worrying about the risk, what could be a more effective combination than telling the underlying instruments are AAA, the counterparty is AAA, what are you worried about? You know, what scenario? Now, if you sort of reverse engineer it, if you ask that question and took it seriously, what scenario are you worried about? Well, the scenario which is AAA company writes so much protection on the AAA asset does, turns out to be AAA, and it takes down the AAA company. But, again...
Well, and the idea that they're writing protection on AAA assets that are all the same type.
Yeah.
Not AAA assets, some of which are in housing or some of which are in, but that there is a specific concentration in.
Right.
So this has mostly been about credit derivatives, and one of the debates that we've been having in the commission is to what extent other derivatives, the older, more traditional interest rate and forex derivatives might have played in the crisis, possibly through counterparty risk or spreading concern about counterparties. Is there anything to?
I'm not aware of anything. Really, that's not to say I haven't missed something, but much as there have been things that didn't work very well, there are other things that work pretty well. Lehman failed, huge, you know, amount, you know, makes LTCM look like a tiny entity. Mm-hmm. And you know, the closeout per se of those derivatives contracts didn't bring down any of their counterparties. And again, I think the difference is anybody dealing with Lehman knew that was a risk. It was not a AAA-rated entity. It was always kind of an iffy counterparty. So you didn't, you managed your transactions with Lehman, so you didn't create huge exposures that would land you in insolvency if Lehman went down. So I'm just not aware. I don't know what you're hearing. I mean, almost all the problems I'm aware of that I'm convinced are problems were related to the structured credit segment. And again, I think that's because of the anesthetizing feature of the AAA rating and the anesthetizing effects of the AAA rating of the counterparties in those cases, which was flawed reasoning in retrospect, but held powerful sway at the time. The only other thing on interest rate derivatives we're beginning to hear things about, you know, municipals, but we're trying to sort out ourselves how much of that is simply how much of that was, say, dealing in off-market transactions and bamboozling the municipalities on the one hand, versus simply municipality. Let's see if I can get this right. Issued floating rate debt, swap floating at the fixed, rates have declined. Now, gee, they really wish they hadn't entered into that floating to fixed swap because they're paying out huge amounts in the swap and they're not realizing that, but by the same token, their debt costs have gone down because floating rates have collapsed to where they've collapsed. And of course, they can't have it both ways. If they wanted the protection against the rise in rates, they had to take the risk that they would be giving up their opportunity to profit from falling rates. So how much of it is just stressed municipalities looking to get out of transactions that were that had nothing questionable about them, as opposed to questionable transactions, I think. Only time will tell. Clearly, some of the latter. How much we're trying to get our own hands around that.
Where does suitability come into play with the municipalities? Yeah. In terms
we never liked that word as an SEC word, but we had a word called appropriateness. Appropriateness.
Okay.
And there is a view that when you're dealing with less sophisticated counterparties, a bank, the bank must analyze whether the transaction is appropriate for that counterparty. In other words, it's not caveat emptor with regard. If you're dealing with Goldman Sachs, you know, Goldman Sachs can take care of itself. You don't have to analyze whether they're doing the smart thing or not. But if you're dealing with some municipality, you probably should do some worrying about whether, again, it's all tied around the concept of reputation risk, that if you enter into this transaction and it turns out badly for the municipality, maybe that won't look so good for you, even if you made money on it.
You're referring to the complex structured finance guidance? Or
even before that,
yeah.
we had guidance. Because remember, the thing about complex structured transactions was the appropriateness stuff wasn't implicated because Enron was imperfectly. It was the most sophisticated counterparty. There was no in loco parentis for Exxon. You were not required to do an analysis of whether this transaction was appropriate under that doctrine. Mm-hmm. Then we expanded that doctrine to say, well, you really should be asking whether mm-hmm. they're using this transaction for some nefarious purpose.
So one question that has come up, which I guess you mentioned briefly, is just, you know, why was there systemic risk created if for every credit default swap that was exercised, there's one party that lost money and one party mm-hmm. that gained money, so it's all awash systemically?
Mm-hmm.
And I can come up with an answer, but I'd like to hear how you would respond to that.
Well, I think the answer is that you were. Instead of transferring the risk to the parties that were most able to manage it, you were transferring it to parties who ultimately couldn't pay it off.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, within as long as the amount of risk transference is not threatening the solvency of other counterparty, I think that it's a zero-sum game is fine. But now if in fact the party that's losing can't pay to the party that's gaining, and that in turn is causing it to default on other obligations to people that were not transactions to derivatives contracts, but the various kinds of debt instruments and whatnot, and there are bankruptcy costs associated with their failure, then that's a little bit too simple and slick. Who's arguing that?
I think it's a matter of understanding where the losses were and why they were.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious the losses were in the first instance at the monolines at AIG, and if you read at least some of the reporting, not that I generally applaud the reporting of the New York Times on derivatives, but with respect to some of their work in figuring out who were some of the folks that were shorting it's clear that a bunch of hedge funds, Paulson and others, were the big winners from that. The world isn't a better place for wealth having been transferred from AIG and the model lines to those hedge funds. But I don't blame the hedge funds. I blame the others. But
there's a pause, but that doesn't mean we're out of questions.
I have a couple of specific questions, but they're not as focused on derivatives. So.
Go ahead.
Good. I'm tired of derivatives. Maybe I'll perk up with repos. You can ask about repos.
No.
No, we are interested in repos.
No, I'm interested. This question sort of relates to your current role in banking supervision and regulation. We understand from the Fed's most recent review of the New York Fed's supervision of Citigroup that the board here found some significant weaknesses in the New York Fed's oversight of Citi, particularly with respect to risk management and risk oversight. And I just wanted to ask you if you know what changes, if any, have been made to the New York Fed's supervision of Citi, whether it be staffing or whether it's involved more board involvement or...
Well, I can speak to the latter. I mean, we... And Chairman Bernanke's been speaking about this, Governor Carullo, and I think Governor Carullo will be giving some more details shortly. But just we have created a new governance structure for large bank supervision that I think...
When did that happen? Or it's not going right
we
now?
We had our first meeting last week.
Okay.
So it's not really... We're standing it up
as
we speak. But for the largest institutions, we created something called the Large Institution Supervision Coordination Committee, which I chair, so that I think in the last few years, Greg knows this better than I don't think the division director was very much involved in the supervision of large firms. And we've also involved, part of the notion here is that, one of the arguments the Fed makes for why it should be involved in supervision is that we have, as a central bank, expertise that's hard to replicate anywhere else, whether that's expertise in macroeconomics, financial markets, payment and settlement systems, et cetera. But I think it's fair to say, as we look back, that we didn't always bring that expertise effectively to bear, that like a lot of big organizations, we have this problem with siloing and communications not being ideal. And we think that in the SCAP exercise, where we really did effectively bring that all together to do this stress test of the largest firms, we're trying essentially to modify the governance of supervision to make sure we bring that kind of expertise to bear consistently in the future, so that all of the other division directors, the economists and lawyers and whatnot at the board or on that group, our markets experts from New York or on the group, the payment and settlement experts, in addition to the heads of supervision at the Reserve Banks, including, of course, the New York Fed. And then we have an operating committee under that, too, where we bring together the best experts in the system, both in supervision and elsewhere, to, as Greg can attest, vet the ratings of these institutions, vet the supervisory plans, talk about what the messages are and the right messages. You know, that is the main approach. It does involve greater centralization. I think it's going to involve more aggressive, more senior peer review of the ratings being assigned. And, you know, one of the lessons learned, the New York Fed has had its own lessons learned exercise, and I think it acknowledges that it didn't always react quickly enough. It wasn't always tough enough. I'm learning more every day, forming views about how things work, but I've even asked people at other agencies, it does seem there's a sort of natural tendency for the people on the ground in the institution to be a little more sympathetic to the institution that people that are not talking to them every day or are somewhat removed. So bringing in a bunch of folks, both in Washington and the other reserve banks, at a more senior level. But there's always been a vetting process, but my sense is that it was not terribly effective for a variety of reasons, including not having people in Washington senior enough or philosophically disposed to really take on the people on the ground. And we think we've changed that. I guess only time will tell.
One of our colleagues quoted Bill Taylor from way back as saying, if you send your scout over to the other team, eventually he's not your scout.
It's like Avatar.
That's the city team.
But any specific knowledge of what's going on with the city right now?
Specific knowledge of what's going on with the city? Well, we're monitoring them closely. As you know, they have this plan to they've essentially divided up the company into what they regard as the core strategic part of the business versus City Holdings, which is actually not a legal entity, but a list of the businesses they'd like to sell. And they have been selling significant amounts of assets, but it's been going a little more slowly than we might like, so they're getting some pressure on that. I think one of the important things we did was, in connection with their TARP repayment, we convinced them that they need to issue a lot of common equity to finance that. So, in fact, their capital structure is much stronger than it was formerly now that they issued all that common and replaced the sort of less than common Treasury TARP stock with common stock. On the risk management front, that's a company that hasn't done risk management very well for at least 20 years, and we're pressuring them, and they're making progress, but it's a big aircraft carrier, and some of their problems related to bad management information systems and things that aren't easy to change overnight. You know, you can. I think you need to push them to have a plan and to have a timetable and milestones and deliverables and all that, but you can't overnight fundamentally turn crummy management information systems into good ones. It just takes time.
Are you happy with the New York Feds, what they're doing with Citi right now?
I think so. We still have discussions from time to time, and we don't always agree, but we've been working things out.
So that was my city question.
Okay.
You used to be the city analyst, weren't you, Greg?
No, I was Wachovia.
Wachovia.
And then I had a handful of new bank holding companies.
I see.
Which
sorry. I'm sorry for that slur.
I'm learning more about it here.
Well, I could ask one more question back on sort of on the derivatives front and sort of on sort of the deregulatory mindset at the Fed. Would like your thoughts, because I think that Chairman Greenspan has specifically spoke in his October 2008 testimony about some things that he saw that had turned out differently maybe than he expected them to. But derivatives did not seem to be one of the things that he thought there'd been a big mistake on. And I wondered what your views were on that based on your interactions with him over the course of the time that you worked together on the derivatives issues with the president's working group.
Well, you know, he left before the stuff hit the fan, right? So I don't have to say, I'm not going to claim, and I don't remember ever having views sharply at odds with Chairman Greenspan's. It's hard to say how, you know, my views have changed faced with the harsh life reality. I would hope that his views would have changed too if faced with that same harsh light. I can't say how much he knows or I haven't gotten through his Brookings piece and what he said in there, but about halfway through, he has acknowledged. I mean, he said it obliquely. Wasn't there this famous thing that Waxman extracted from him where he said that he expected counterparty discipline to be more effective? Well, I think that's true, and probably what he heard from supervisors was, as far as we can tell, they were doing a pretty good job. That turned out not to be right. And any time you had a belief that appears to have been challenged by reality, I think you have to figure out in what ways your beliefs need to be modified. And I think in this case, a lot more scrutiny to how they measure counterparty risks. Number one, that's getting at the potential future exposure issue, but not more stress testing, etc. Although, again, that depends on your having enough imagination to test against. If anyone had said in 2006 you should test against a 40% house decline, people would have thought you are out of your mind. You need to leave the Fed and go start your blog and talk about who really shot Kennedy and other things, you know. But still, going forward, we have to try to do better with that. And then again, the other lessons about let's not just focus on hedge funds. Let's look at anybody who's large and leveraged and ask, are we being as demanding of them as we are of hedge funds? In fact, I think those would be some of the things. And then I think support. We've come around to supporting more clearing. I still think, at least me personally, I worry a little bit, having studied how clearing organizations work, about putting too many things into clearing organizations, including things that maybe will not be so successful. One of the things I always put out is a central counterparty is a counterparty, so if you think there are difficulties managing counterparty risk on certain instruments, that does not change when you put them into the centralized environment. It just puts the burden on the centralized entity, which better get it right, because everything's going through it. But we're certainly favorably disposed to, again, I don't know what the chairman has said about the proposals the administration has made on derivatives, but I would think we're broadly supportive. And what exactly to do about the definition of significant market, what is it, significant swap participant or major swap participant, I don't know. It just strikes me. I think I'm kind of surprised. It just seems to me there's some black and white areas, and there's this big gray area. And why a Senator Gray and a Senator Reid couldn't figure out, you know, to agree to put down a marker somewhere in the gray area is sort of beyond me. I don't know what pressures are coming to bear on them, but that it struck me, having essentially created the administration blueprint, that now somebody admittedly had to do the hard work of turning the blueprint into legislation, where you had to make some of the tough decisions that we very intentionally elided because they would have gotten in the way of near-term agreement. I didn't think it should be so hard to fill in those blanks, but I don't. I'm far removed from it, so.
Supple.
Well, I could bring up a couple other subjects. Is that okay?
Can I ask just one quick question?
Yeah, sure.
So you talked about the anesthetizing role of AAA ratings.
Hmm.
To what extent were the regulators themselves subject to that?
I think to an important extent. I mean, part of it is, you know, and this is where
When the rating agencies got beaten up over Enron, I was very sympathetic to the rating agencies. I mean, basically it was a fraud enabled by their auditors. Now, how are they supposed to do better than the auditors? And their track record, you know, no one's going to be perfect, but viewed over many years, the track record of those rating agencies in rating corporate bond is pretty damn good, I think. Now, the problem was that generated all this credibility for them, and then they took on structured credit where they didn't have a track record and hadn't lived, much as they lived through many corporate credit cycles that they can learn from. They had never lived through a cycle where housing prices, you know, declined, so that they made some of the same errors we did. Now, I think in addition on things like ABS CDOs, the whole... I think the whole concept of an ABS CDO is a bit of an abomination. That a CDO, you know, the fundamental thing is first you have diversification effects. You put the stuff, pull it together, and you know, the whole is less risky than the parts. And then you tranche it. And tranching it clearly does mean that there's got to be some portion. You know, some people say, how could it be that you have a AAA security when the underlying assets aren't AAA? Well, gee, if 80% of the people are junior to you, I understand how that works. There's nothing. That's not alchemy. That works. The problem is if the underlying pool is not diversified and there's an event that blows through all of it. And the problem is, whereas with corporate CDOs, we're default, you know, where corporations... Even in a stress environment, not all of them are defaulting. The correlation is pretty low. I think the rating agencies thought, well, okay, we recognize that ABS are a little bit different in the scenario in which one mortgage-backed security is in trouble is going to be the sort of the same. So they goosed up the correlation assumptions a little bit, but really quite modestly. And I think the point is the only sort of economic environment in which one mortgage-backed security is in trouble is one in which most of them are going to be in trouble, so that you're not going to get much diversification effect. So maybe that was a financial innovation too far, or a application of a reasonably a poor implementation of what started out as a reasonably sound idea.
And the bank examiners themselves didn't question. Clearly, the rating agencies got it wrong. But then was there an independent analysis done? And
by the investors?
No, by the banking regulators.
I don't think we ever viewed that as our job. I mean, we would have said, and I know we have always said this, that in terms of banks relying on ratings, they're to do their own independent credit analysis, and obviously that didn't happen. Where we may be justifiably criticized is in using the ratings uncritically in our regs. So we sort of did the exact thing we said they shouldn't do making use of ratings in setting cap requirements. Now, I think what we would have said historically is, okay, well, what's the alternative? We saw the whole sort of origin of Basel I was a recognition that if you don't have risk-adjusted ratios, they will game the unrisk-adjusted ratio. If you try to put pressure on them to raise capital, they'll substitute risky assets for safe assets, and if your measurement system doesn't pick that up, you'll come to regret it. And we sort of pursued that logic to ever more complicated, almost incomprehensible risk measurement systems, for better or for worse. So then the question is, how do you gauge the riskiness of different assets? And, you know, there are a lot of people that are very skeptical of using the bank's models, but if you're not going to use the bank's models, you're not going to use the rating agent, what are you going to use? I mean, you've got to use something. Mm-hmm. And in the case of corporate credit, they had such a strong track record. I don't think that was such a bad decision. Maybe we, too, should have questioned whether that should extrapolate into contents in their rating of asset-backed securities. And we didn't do that, but... didn't do that.
So how's that currently working on capital requirements?
Oh,
how do the ratings currently play into the capital requirements now? Have there been any changes?
There have been. I'm not on top of all these details, yeah, but we've substantially increased the
gap requirements and security. In fact, probably so much that we may have overdone it.
I mean, they're going through a quantitative analysis this year, so I'm not sure what's actually been done yet.
Those results aren't in. But that's only to set the, whether it's 8% or 6% or 10% according to some. And I think the other view is that we got some of the stuff. The first tranche, which was adjusting the risk weights, that's already been completed. And then in November, December, whatever, Basel came up with another proposal sort of dealing with what counts as capital and limits on types of capital instruments and then some stuff on counterparty risk. And that's and then they're going to do this QIS, but my sense is the QIS is only to at least some interpreters only deciding what the target ratio is and not dealing with the weights, and we screwed up some of the weights, so we may have to redo that. So,
but it's still tied to credit ratings in the new regs, or have they moved away from using credit?
I don't think they've moved away from it completely, but I'm going to plead ignorance of the details on that one.
Yeah, we're going to get more on this week.
There you go. She will give you chapter and verse.
So I was going to ask about consolidated supervision.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the remarkable things, and we've been doing a case study on Citigroup,
mm-hmm.
and so investigator types of.
Are you going to share it with us? I'd be interested in reading it.
Are we allowed to? I don't think so.
Well, it'll come out eventually. Why?
Well, the paper will.
Okay.
Yeah. But so there have been conversations with the OCC, conversations with the Fed, conversations with the SEC, and the remarkable thing is that the CDO business wasn't anybody's fault.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the banks were writing liquidity puts, but the OCC says, you know, we had to rely on the investment bank analysis. But the SEC says we were just watching the capital of the company, mm-hmm. and the Fed says, well, you take out the bank and you take out the securities firm, there weren't a whole lot of non-bank subs for us to look at. So, you know, nobody's really guilty when it comes to Citi. Mm-hmm. It's hard to believe that's the case. So at some point, the question is, what could the Fed have done within Gramsci Filali, using whatever tools were available?
Did we understand the CDO business even ask the right questions? I don't know the answer to that question.
Did we ask the right questions? I mean, the impression that we're getting from the interviews we've had is that the OCC had done some exams in 05, 06, mm-hmm. and had a good grip on it mm-hmm. to some extent. Didn't really follow up on the way it was transformed over 06 and 07 to take really aggressive one-way bets. We haven't found evidence that the Fed did much at all.
So my sense,
and the SEC was completely oblivious to the issue, it seems.
I don't know what we did, but my sense in general with the problem was that narrowly looking at the problem, not from society's standpoint, but from Citigroup's standpoint,
mm-hmm.
that for a while they really were distributing the risk. They weren't retaining the risk.
Mm-hmm.
And then as people started to get nervous and AIG stopped writing protection on the senior tranches,
mm-hmm.
but gee, they've gotten addicted to making all this money out of originating CDOs,
mm-hmm.
they said, well, you know, we don't want that revenue stream to dry up,
mm-hmm.
and what we'll do is just retain these low risk tranches, or we'll write the liquidity puts or whatever, and that's pretty riskless. And after mm-hmm. all, we're making a hell of a lot of money here. And that was sort of the mindset. I don't know whether that's right or wrong, but
I think that's right from a Citigroup point of view. But I'm questioning it from a supervisor point.
But see, what I'm saying is, if you had examined it in 2005, even
mm-hmm.
you might have not seen the risk retention. Because there might not have been any risk retention.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that this does boggle the mind is how rapidly this stuff grew. You know, as you mm-hmm. know, just even at the rate of issues like non-traditional mortgages, how fast the non-traditional part gobbled up the whole mortgage market, that we went from
mm-hmm.
a conventional mortgage market to one where the conventional segment was. That happened over like 2 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing could have been true. Sort of the OCC, I guess my point is sort of a defense of the OCC maybe, or at least a question I would ask. They could have done the exam in 2005 and found nothing wrong because, at least in terms of things burned, that there was nothing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years later, it's completely different.
Yeah. But I think that's, I mean, certainly the CDO issuance was substantial
mm-hmm.
I mean, and quick
yeah.
in terms of the number of deals they were churning out every month.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not all blaming each other. We're just all saying it wasn't our fault. That's better than the alternative.
No, there's been a little bit of that. I think, I mean, Dugin, public, this wasn't even in our work. I mean, Dugin said that, none of this stuff happened in the bank, which is kind of impressive interpretation of what happened.
Well, until the Sunday's New York Times, I was just amazed that we always get beaten up and they didn't, but I guess he had his turn this weekend. I don't know if you saw it.
I didn't see that.
It was mainly on the consumer preemption issue. I don't know I always wonder how these arguments, how these articles get written, and who was guiding the writing of the article. But it was someone who was not a fan of the controller. Well, actually, I think, again, I'm not a OCC basher or a Dugin basher, so I'm always sad to see it. But on the other hand, we've been getting beaten up so much that, misery loves miserable company, as I was once told. So,
well, the criticism I've heard in the corridors of our commission is that the Fed should have done more with the non-bank subs. And even to the extent of notice that the SEC wasn't really doing a rigorous program over with the CSEs, and
I don't know what we done about that.
Well, I mean, we were relying on the SEC to regulate the investment bank at Citi, for instance.
Mm-hmm. So that was the direction of the Congress, was it not?
It was, but there was words written in there in Gramm-Leach Bowie that said if you're concerned about the safety and soundness of the bank, of these subsidiaries, it was a very high standard. I've heard the argument in our group that we have the tools right there, even in the language before the way Geithner's trying to edit it. We had the ability to say the banks being threatened.
I work with the SEC. I had nothing to do with supervision over the years, but I work with the SEC a lot on a lot of different things, and. A lot of times we had differences of opinion. But other times we worked together. And how hard you push them on an issue you disagree, you're not going to push them as hard if you realize that tomorrow I may need them to help me with something else. For example, our efforts were not all that successful, our efforts to reform the tri-party repo market and whatnot, they were always fully supported. If you're bashing their supervision of broker dealers, it's not likely to continue for very much longer. So that's sort of the reality of things. It's not only was intended to be a high bar, but it's one where you can't imagine that trying to clear the bar isn't going to poison relationships in ways that wouldn't be helpful in many ways. I guess which maybe is a way of saying that the statutory framework wasn't very good.
Can you be more specific? I mean, what's
again? Obviously the thing that now the administration is pushing that large complex institutions, regardless, this doesn't get to very much time for you, but regardless of their whether they own a bank is narrowly defined in the Bank Holding Company Act, ought to be regulated as bank holding companies. And if you're expecting, as we now are, we expect the purpose of bank holding company supervision to be not primarily, much less solely protecting the insurer of the eye, but protecting the system from the fallout from failure of the entity, you've got to have more robust authority for the consolidated supervisor, you got to get rid of those Gramm-Leach Bowie constraints, which Dodd has now recognized, has he not? As we pointed out, in Bernanke's last statement, so that it doesn't sound so terribly, we didn't have the authority we needed, but neither did the other regulators. They, too, were focused on the legal entity, not on systemic things. The SEC, in particular, had a very, very narrow focus, other than this one they ginned up in the CSE regime, which always had questionable strength and validity. My sense was over the years, when the SEC never asked for authority from the Congress to do the consolidated supervision. Not because the people at the SEC, certainly during the Levitt regime,
didn't secretly want that authority, but rather because they were pretty sure if they asked Congress for the authority, they wouldn't get it. And what's the percentage in pissing off the Congress asking for authority and not getting it? That was not in their interest.
This is going to come from out of left field, but another thing that came up from one of the academics we had was we've had a lot of discussions about the breakdown in the shadow banking system. And I mean, the story there has to do with too much leverage and not enough margins in some markets. So the question is, could the Fed do more to regulate margins within its existing authority? And this gets down to Reg T, which is a regulation that I don't understand.
It's a very complicated regulation, and as it applies to things that aren't equities, you've got to talk to the lawyers as to what we would have had authority to do. I think any effort on our part to regulate leverage in the fixed income markets through our margin authority would have gone nowhere. What happened to rulemaking would have been ferociously opposed. And fundamentally, I don't think margin instrument specific margin requirements are the way to constrain leverage. I think you have to regulate the capital and liquidity of entities that are engaging in the transactions. Now that you've mentioned the shadow banking system, I mean, I think really you can ask. I don't think we understood at all well the dimensions of the shadow banking system. Maybe we should have known more. Maybe we weren't always as inquisitive as we should have been. I mean, for example, I think we knew. I mean, after all, the Fed is the source of public information on the commercial paper market, so we knew there was an enormous asset-backed commercial paper market. We got the statistics from DTC, so you can quantify it down to the last nickel. But just speaking for myself, I mean, I knew it was 1 point whatever trillion or whatever the heck it was. But and early on, when I learned about asset-backed commercial paper when I was a young man, I knew that basically those were like programs that Citi had set up to finance corporate receivables off balance sheets. So it was short-term assets being funded with commercial paper, and that didn't look so risky, high quality corporate receivables. And I had no idea that it had been transformed into basically, to a large extent, financing the AAA rated tranches of securitizations through commercial paper. And that may be another instance where in retrospect, our siloing didn't help us much. There were people in supervision that knew that SIVs existed, for example, SIVs being a particular type of ABCP issuer, because the banks that were sponsoring wanted to know what capital requirement NARA was charging on the capital notes that those banks issued. But sort of once they had analyzed it and decided what the capital requirements was, they'd done their thing. And it was not their job to monitor, having blessed a particular capital treatment of a particular instrument, how many of those were actually issued. And maybe that was somebody else's job, but they really weren't talking to NORA, so they didn't know so that's the sort of thing you get into. And that's the sort of thing we're trying to deal with through this new structure. Sec lending markets, that was totally in the shadows. Nobody.
What?
Securities lending. Have you heard about securities lending?
I've had some great conversations in the past week, I can tell you.
$3 trillion? Is that what it got up to in the U.S.?
I haven't figured it out yet. Is that what occurred?
There were some guys, you had to talk to. There's a group that started a central counterparty. I believe they worked with the Options Clearing Corporation to set up a central counterparty for sec lending transactions. And they, in doing their market research, their CEO, it's a guy who used to run Bank of New York's dealer services, whose name is going to escape me, that heads it. But they had a lot of information. And actually, the Risk Management Association has a lot of information on sec lending.
But number one, I don't think anybody realized how huge that got. But if, really, I suppose, again, if you sat back and thought about it, you knew there was a whole lot of long-short arbitrage being dug by hedge funds. We're going to short something at the borrow the security. That means somebody's lending the security.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., that means you're taking in cash collateral,
mm-hmm.
right, to the lender of the security gets the cash, and then the question is what he does with it. Now, again, I would have thought, at least put it in T-bills. You know, at least put it in something safe. EIG put it in AAA rated subprime RMBS, which wasn't such a good idea. And they were not alone. I mean, they were alone in putting all of it in. I mean, more sensible people said, mm-hmm. well, you know, the SEC borrower could at any time say he wanted to return the securities and had to give his cash back, so I'd better manage my liquidity so I'd actually have cash to give back.
Mm-hmm.
But they used the usual kind of analysis of liquidity, so they would put some of it in less liquid things and mm-hmm. most of it in more liquid things. And then AIG, of course, went for broke and put it all in AAA-rated RMBS. So they were engaging in maturity transformation.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that show up in the national accounts? I have no idea where mm-hmm. it shows up in the national accounts, but it's not showing up. It's a pension fund lending the securities, taking in the cash and investing it in something else.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? I just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The Foreign Central Bank truly doesn't send up in our accounts. So that was another huge part of the shadow banking system. It's still pretty much in the shadows. But all these things were entities were pretty highly leveraged and engaged in maturity transformation and not subject to any... Think about a pension fund.
Mm-hmm.
It's not subject to any capital requirement whatsoever. I mean, it's regulated, I guess, by the Labor Department. Remember when we told Paulson that it was pension funds were regulated? He came in and said, well, how are pension funds regulated? So we told him by the Labor Department. He found that amusing. Then I think he met the Secretary of Labor. He found it even more amusing. The Secretary of Labor, who probably, I will say no more. I don't even remember who it was. And I'm sure that in the new administration, it's somebody who in the Labor Department is completely on top of the pension fund issues, because mm-hmm. that's what the labor unions want in their mm-hmm. labor secretary. In any event, so I don't think we knew a whole lot about that. We hope to do better in the future. We've got this vaunted Financial Stability Oversight Council we're going to get together, and the whole is going to be a whole lot bigger than the sum of the parts, I'm told. Years of experience with the PWG makes me question whether that's going to happen magically, but we'll see. But that's the part. There's some parts. It's always amazing. The New York Times eventually told the story about the synthetic ABS CDOs and the people that were short in the housing market. I don't think anybody's told the SEC lending story.
I mean, just a quick internet search. It was actually being discussed with respect to AIG already in April of 2008.
Really?
Yeah. So, and it was because the insurance companies were reporting losses. The AIG insurance companies were reporting losses through the funds that AIG was managing for the insurance companies. Which is funny, because once the crisis happened, it was all about CDS and the SEC lending part of it, which was, I guess, what one of the whole Maiden Lanes was for, was SEC lending.
I've been punished for many of my sins, but I've not been punished by having anything to do with AIG, which is the most severe punishment for any Federal Reserve employee. But people have told me that they lost as much on the SEC lending transactions as they did on the CDS transactions. And talk about, we always like to talk about complexity. There's nothing very complex about taking the corporate bonds that an insurance company invested in, lending them out ostensibly in the first place to make a few basis points on the SEC mm-hmm. loan, mm-hmm. then taking the cash collateral and decide I can make a few more basis points by putting them at the AAA rated RMBS, but not very complicated. I mean, it's unfamiliar to people, but doesn't require any PhD in physics to understand those transactions,
mm-hmm.
and they lost a lot of money.
Yep. So, well, this is coming on 2 hours.
It is.